This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Rinku Sen, the president and director of the Applied Research Center and the publisher of Color Lines magazine at colorlines.com. I think you've dropped the magazine from it. You beat Newsweek to the punch of going all electronic, and we at the Progressive are still have our one leg in one world and one leg in the other. We're doing the splits. I've long wanted to meet you. I've been reading your stuff over at Color Lines a long time. Welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much, Matt. Glad to be here.
Why don't you describe what Color Lines is for the person who's never been to your website at colorlines.com?
Sure. Colorlines.com is a daily news site that is laser-focused on race and racial justice. So we cover the nation's race news, we break stories and do original reporting, and also provide a lot of commentary on pretty much everything from race in the popular culture to race in politics.
Well, race in politics is big right now because we're at the end of this long presidential campaign, and I wonder how you see race being used or misused in this current election.
Well, I definitely think that the presidential campaigns themselves, the Romney campaign and the Obama campaign, are thinking a lot about race inside of the campaigns. There was Mitt Romney's recent flubbed but Freudian slip when he said that if his father had actually been Mexican, he'd have an easier time with Latino voters in this election.
What do you make of that?
Well, I don't think it's actually true that if his father had been Mexican, but really if his father had been Mexican, he wouldn't be Mitt Romney. I mean,
exactly.
the whole idea that you can just put a person into another skin and they would still be the same person is kind of ludicrous, because our life choices and our conditions, the material conditions of our lives, are so shaped by the rules that we enter into, and those rules are really different for a Romney who is actually a Mexican versus a Romney who's an American living in Mexico.
And he was famous during the Republican primary debates for talking about self-deportation, and then I saw him in the second debate when Latina questioner asked a question about the undocumented, and he responded by using the word illegals.
Yes. Well, he said undocumented illegals, which is just hilarious to me, because that's clearly him hedging. He knows that the word illegals is dehumanizing. He knows that Latino voters don't like it, that they find it offensive. They find it really directed toward Latinos and their communities. And he also knows that there's a campaign afoot to get people to stop using it and to use undocumented instead. So the idea of using undocumented illegals to satisfy both of the camps that he's trying to get into is really very Romney-esque.
And you've done a campaign over at Color Lines just about this word illegal. Tell the listener about that campaign.
Yeah, we are doing a campaign to get people to stop using the language of illegality in relation to the immigration debate. We think that's important for a couple of reasons. For journalists in particular, is important because it's not actually an accurate way to describe people who are here without authorization or without papers. If you might recall that during the actual debate, when the woman who asked that question brought it up, she never used the word. She said, you know, what's your notion of what to do with people who are here without green cards? And, you know, unless a judge has made a determination that somebody is out of status, then really we have no business as reporters, say, putting that label on people that we have not clarified. It's not commonly used in legal circles either. Supreme Court justices have not used it and have used the word undocumented instead. Globally, the word that's usually used is irregular. So we're okay with many other words, undocumented, unauthorized, but we do not like the word that attaches an identity to people because of one particular thing that they've done.
I'm speaking with Rinku Sen. She is the publisher of Color Lines, colorlines.com. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I was at a framing seminar, and some pollster came up with data that says, yeah, he knows that it's not appropriate to use the term illegal, but it's the best term to use if you want to persuade people who aren't Latino, because that's the phrase that, you know, that's how they view things. And so start with them where they're at. How do you respond to that?
You know what? I know a lot of great organizers who work in communities in Idaho and Montana and Maine, places that are really very white and are known for being white. And when they're on the doors canvassing people and talking to people about immigration and immigration policy, they don't use the word and they don't have a problem. So the question is, are you willing to have an actual conversation with people, or are you just trying to sell them something? And if you're just trying to sell them something, then you'll say whatever you think they want to hear. But if you're really engaging them politically, then you have to lead with what your actual values are, and you have to help people think through what is the actual situation that people without papers find themselves in. What are their family situations? What are their economic situations? Why are they in that position in the first place? And when you're, and it doesn't take days and days to have that conversation. It takes a couple of pointed questions and the willingness to listen and engage.
Why do you think there's been this backlash against undocumented people in the United States?
Oh, I just think a lot of it really is racial. It's racial anxiety. It's clearly, even though there are many different kinds of people who are without papers, there's several hundred thousand Irish undocumented immigrants. There are a number of Russians. My own people, I'm Indian immigrant. Indians are the sixth largest group of people without papers in the country. However, the phrase illegal immigrant has really become a stand-in for Latinos, for Mexicans in particular. And it's so unfair to me to tell Mexicans that they should get in line like everybody else. The legal immigration processes, the formal processes, have never been fair to Mexicans. They're too close. They're too good a source of cheap labor. And our immigration policy is designed to deny them a legal path to residency. And so, It's really, when people say illegal immigration or illegal immigrant, they're really talking about Latinos and they're afraid of Latinos kind of taking over the United States.
Rinku Sen, how do you assess the Obama administration's policy on immigration or policies on immigration?
I think it's been disappointing. I do. Comprehensive immigration reform failed to pass for half a dozen years before President Obama came into office, and he pledged during his campaign that he would be committed to it, make it happen. And I think he had other priorities in the first 2 years of his presidency, healthcare reform in particular. And I also think that the political climate on immigration, the public will to actually make room for the undocumented people who are here now and to really fix our immigration system, has been going in the other direction, in a much more nativist, restrictionist direction. And I don't, I'm happy about the administrative things that he's done. They aren't, I'm skeptical about the implementation of those administrative orders.
And this is about the DREAM Act kind of thing.
Yeah, there's the deferred action, which is a way of not deporting young people who would be eligible for the DREAM Act were it to pass. And but there are other kinds of things as well. There are, you know, in the immigration system, for example, parents, immigrant parents who have U.S. citizen kids are meant to get subject to discretion. An ICE agent mm-hmm. could decide this is not a person who should be detained or deported. They have young kids that they're responsible for. We need to find a different way.
Because ICE had been breaking up families, even during Obama. I mean, Obama was sending away a record number of people.
Yes, and, you know, 400,000 people, about a quarter of them have been parents of young children. We broke a big story last year about the ways in which immigrant parents lose their kids permanently through the family courts, have their family ties severed legally when the kids are in child welfare and the parents are deported. Those kids spend their lives in their childhoods in foster care, or they get put up for adoption. They get adopted by, you know, U.S. citizen parents.
I read the story. The parents never get to see their kids.
Never get to see their kids.
It's a heartbreaking story.
Yeah. And something that just is a really, it's a piece of collateral damage from our immigration policy and the way we carry it out that Americans really need to think about. Do we really want policy carried out in our name that takes kids, innocent kids, away from loving families for no good reason? Mm.
I'm speaking with Rinku Sen. She's the publisher of Color Lines Magazine. I still call it Color Lines Magazine. It's Colorlines,
okay.
Colorlines.com. It's not in print anymore. They were pathbreakers that way. There are a couple other issues, racial issues, that have surfaced in this election campaign, and these have been surfaced by Republicans largely in what I consider to be racist attacks against African Americans. And by that, I mean the whole food stamp president thing that Gingrich talked about. And actually, there was Romney in the second debate talking about food stamps again and mm-hmm. the increasing number of people on food stamps or this work requirements being eased by President Obama for people on welfare. And, of course, I was always against Clinton's welfare reform anyway. Mm-hmm. But there you have that. And so how crude do you think this is, or how direct is this aimed at white Americans who have biases that can be played upon?
Well, food stamp president is clearly a dog whistle that is meant to bring up also the image of the quote-unquote welfare queen, which Ronald Reagan popularized during his campaign. And they're really stand-ins for visuals of black Americans who are considered freeloaders. So Romney's 47% and the food stamp president go really hand in hand together. But I don't think the Democrats are totally safe in this regard. I think that the electoral obsession with the middle class is actually also a kind of dog whistle. Middle class is meant to indicate the right kind of white people, married white people who quote unquote work, and white people who are poor, white people who don't make it so well in this society. They're kind of honorary people of color. And if we were having a real conversation about poverty, for example, in this election cycle.
Which we aren't.
Which we are not. And the reason we're not is because there's just a set of people who are marginalized. There are certainly people of color who are marginalized, but poor white people or white people who don't act right, you know, white people who are white women, for example, who try to get birth control or abortions, both parties have been hedging, I think, around the condition of white people who live on the margins of the society, partly, and that kind of puts the white people into the same category as people of color.
You know, it's interesting. I want to pick up on both of the aspects of that answer, Rinku Sen. The first, the 47%, Romney's comment about people who are takers, basically, and aren't taking responsibility for themselves and are mooching off the government. I was speaking just this morning with an African-American writer who contributes to The Progressive and the Progressive Media Project, and he said when he and other black Americans he knows heard that, he thought Romney was speaking directly about them. And he
right.
said he had no sense that Romney was talking about anybody else. It was about black Americans, and I hadn't picked up on that right away. And the other thing is this question of on women's reproductive rights. I mean, there in the second debate, Romney all of a sudden is for contraception for all women, which
right.
is another flip-flop. But squarely on the abortion issue, which didn't come up in the second debate,
mm-hmm.
I thought the president was going to get there. He tiptoed around it. But it's just amazing to me. Here you have Paul Ryan, the person who's running for vice president of the United States on the Republican ticket, who would deny every woman in the country who's ever raped and is impregnated by the rapist, deny that woman the right to an abortion. How can that not be a horrifying position for a huge majority of Americans? And why isn't the president making that a bigger story?
Well, I think the Democratic Party has decided to focus on the economy for some strange reason. I think that if they were to expand their commentary and the president's commentary in particular on social issues, they'd actually have some strength and some power. That would be a position of power from which they could run this election.
Right. I thought he was just to go there when he talked about mm-hmm. George W. Bush being better than Romney in a lot of ways, but he didn't take that last step.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, gosh, I don't know. I talk to a lot of different kinds of women, you know, at my gym, not just progressive political women, but just women in the course of life, because there are a lot of us. And it's the birth control issue in particular just has women absolutely irate. And I've noticed that a lot of the women I know are beginning to tell me their abortion stories. I've started to hear quite a number of women in their 60s, for example, tell me about the abortions that they had before abortion was legal, the things that they had to do and what they had to go through and how scary it was and how dangerous it was. And I do think that you know, middle-aged women and older women remember those times, but young women don't yet or didn't experience that kind of repression. And they're in for a serious shock if they think that, you know, the abortion debate can just carry on without them, saying anything.
Yeah, the Paul Ryans of this country are pretty brazen about what they believe, and if they get the power, they're ready to use it, shove it down our throats.
Yeah.
You wrote a very perceptive blog after the second debate about this binders full of women comment that Romney made, but you took it in a direction that other people hadn't taken it. Talk about the point you were making between distinguishing diversity and equity.
Yeah. So Romney said, you know, he had a list of potential cabinet members. The list was all male. He demanded some women. Someone brought him a binder full of women. And the binder full of women, the image is what caught public attention. But what struck me is that he was asked a question about pay equity. What are you going to do to close the pay gap where women are making 77 cents on the dollar for what men are making? And he answered with a question about diversity hiring. But the question wasn't about, do you know enough women that you could put into this position or that position? The question was about, how are you going to ensure that once women are hired, that they are getting paid fairly and getting paid at the same kind of rate that men doing that same job would get paid. And I think it's a distinction we really need to get comfortable with in the United States, because we have been pursuing a diversity strategy, a diversity approach. It's not a bad approach. It's important, but it's only a start. It cannot be our end goal. The end goal, I said in my piece, has to be shared power, responsibility, and reward. That's what equity means, when you share those things in ways that are fair. And just having a diversity approach is limiting, you know, a lot of what people complain about, people of color and all women complain about to me is being tokens, feeling like tokens. They get a job, they're in the bank, they're in the company, they're on the college campus, but when they speak in a meeting, nobody pays any attention to them unless occasionally if a white man repeats the thing that they've just said, then their idea will get some traction. But, you know, having a purely diverse, a simple diversity approach really opens the door to tokenism. What we need is shared power and actual equity, mm-hmm. a situation that's fair for everybody.
How did Obama answer that question? Do you remember?
Yes, he answered by pulling up his record on signing the Lilly Ledbetter Act.
Which was about pay equity.
It was indeed about pay equity. And he does better on the equity questions. But in my piece, I critiqued him too, because he, for example, will say that his plan to support black families who are really suffering in this economy is just to fix the economy, that a rising tide lifts all boats. And that might be true, but that gap between the boats, it's about the gap that we need to focus, not just making everybody do a little better than they're doing now. But when we have those big gaps between groups of people in our society, that costs us something. It costs us an economic growth, and it costs us our feeling of being one community, of being one nation, of being unified. And it generates competitiveness and divisiveness when really we need to be working together to solve our common problems.
Yeah, he's been running his whole political career to say that he's not the president of or for Black Americans.
Yes.
And you can understand why. I mean, the racist white Americans say, you know, there shouldn't be a Black man in the White House, and he's president of Black America. But still, that I've talked to some people in the African-American community who said, you know, we haven't gotten the president to address our issues as we've had other presidents who weren't Black.
And, right.
And so that's kind of an irony here, a paradox.
Well, you know what, Matt? I think presidents definitely matter. Presidents matter, elections matter, but movements matter more. And if we have strong movements, then we can get presidents from whatever side of the aisle, from whichever party, to do the things that we want them to do. Richard Nixon supported a guaranteed minimum income for people. I mean, that concept today is like really, really pie in the sky. But Richard Nixon took office during a movement, during a time where there was real active social movement. And I'm close to many of our current movements, but we, when we're doing political work as progressives, we really need to not, we need to expand our focus from just the policymaking, technocratic elements of our work to really talking to Americans about what we value, what we think is important, and how we're going to stick together as a people and not leave some of us behind.
There have been exciting movements going on in the last 30 years here in the United States at the grassroots, Rinku Sen. What are some that have excited you or motivated you or impressed you?
Well, I'm definitely inspired by the movement for sexual liberation and LGBT rights, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender rights.
A great nonviolent revolution that swept the country.
Awesome. And what strikes me about that movement, which I think is true for others as well, is that, you know, you had a lot of cultural change before you had the political change. The political change is sort of grounded in the cultural change. And then when you have the political change, that drives more cultural change. So that's a movement where I see a lot of lessons for the relationship between culture and politics, and a lot of strategic lessons for us. I think young undocumented people who have been fighting for the DREAM Act have really learned from the LGBT liberation movement.
By coming out.
By asserting their presence in the country and their right to be here, their right to be public, their right to enjoy the benefits that all other Americans enjoy, and their positioning as just as being your neighbor, you know, your neighbor, my neighbor, and someone that you relate to every day, even if you don't know that you do.
Yeah, when people despair about progressive politics in this country, or progressive media for that matter, I have to, you know, confront them and say, look, it's not as bad as you're making it out to be. There's some really exciting things going on, both as far as organizing and also as far as the alternative media, which I've been in for many years, and you have too. And let me just bounce this off here, Rinku Sen. Rinku Sen's the publisher of ColorLines.com. I think the alternative media is stronger now than it's ever been since I've been in it for the last 3.5 decades.
Yeah, I really think that the revolutions in new media technology have worked in our favor largely. You know, the mainstream sets, the New York Times and the ABC Newses, have had a harder time actually, I think, adjusting to the new media atmosphere. Their revenue models have really suffered from the existence of the internet. But for us, for independent media, I think that the internet has really opened up a lot of space for us, not just to create our own stuff, but to distribute it and to remain independent while we distribute it. It's one of the reasons why we cover a lot of media policy, and its racial dimensions at Color Lines, because having a free and ideologically neutral internet, one that doesn't have a lot of boundaries on it, is important and critical to the independent media.
So you're working with groups like Free Press and others that are doing media reform?
Yeah, with Free Press, we work a lot with and cover the work of the Center for Media Justice out of Oakland, and of a national network that they've built called Magnet. One of the issues that they're working on, for example, is the issue of the usurious rates of phone calls, the charge rates of phone calls that go from prisons to homes. So when prisoners use the phone and they make collect calls, phone companies are allowed to charge really ridiculous, five times the amount of a regular phone bill. It's just really,
so it's like $2.25 or something, right?
Taking advantage of people who really have no other choice, no other way to communicate with their families. And this network is, I think the FCC is looking deeply at that issue right now. We need those phone companies to be regulated, and that's very important. I do want to mention one other set of movements that I think are really inspiring, and that's the work that's been done in worker centers. So they're outside of but related to to organized labor, to AFL-CIO unions and Change to Win unions, but they're independent. And 20 years ago when they were starting, there were little wins. But at this point, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, for example, has won a Bill of Rights for domestic workers in New York State, got it through the state legislature in California, only to have it vetoed by supposedly progressive Governor Jerry Brown, but is really putting the issues of domestic workers on the national platform. The Restaurant Opportunity Centers United has chapters all over the country organizing restaurant workers. I think that's in labor and in the economy, that's some of the most exciting work that's out there.
Speaking with Rinku Sen, she's the publisher of Color Lines, Color Lines Magazine, colorlines.com. Young person is listening, or a parent of a young person is listening and wants to know where the best point of entry might be for someone who wants to get engaged in progressive journalism or progressive politics or racial justice journalism, racial justice politics that you've been so intimately involved with for years and years now, Rinku Sen, what advice would you give
him? Well, I would say just get started. Find a local campaign or organization that is actually trying to change some rules. So it's great to work at a soup kitchen or volunteer providing services, but if you want to get into actual change politics, you've got to be part of some organizations that are trying to change the rules. So I definitely encourage people to come to colorlines.com, sign up on our listserv. We host a big conference every year called Facing Race, which is coming up in November, the November 15th to the 17th in Baltimore. I encourage people to come there. But, don't wait till feel like you know enough. You're never going to know enough. Don't wait till your politics are perfect and all your biases are gone. Just join something and get started.
And you'll meet some really interesting people, too. So, Rinku Sen, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.